From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
As many of us heavy up on native plants and transition larger areas of our landscapes towards more naturalistic styles of design, there's a lot to learn, or maybe unlearn, if our gardening experience up until now was a bit more traditionally formal and ornamentally focused. A new book called Your Natural Garden by garden designer Kelly Norris asks and answers a lot of the questions we may find ourselves encountering along the way. He's here today to share some advice on making and maintaining an ecological garden, so more in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Kelly Norris, based in Des Moines, Iowa, is an ecological garden designer and author whose latest book is Your Natural Garden, a practical guide to caring for an ecologically vibrant home garden. Kelly is the former director of horticulture and education at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden, and I'm so glad to welcome him today. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and congratulations on the new book. And how is it in Des Moines so far in this new year? What's doing out there?
It's a bit chilly, but you know, it is January in Des Moines. So we sort of expect that at some point we're going to see some below zero temperatures and a little snow cover. So it's on par for winter.
Okay. So I think what we'll do with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com is we'll have a book giveaway of the new book. Of a copy of the new book, Your Natural Garden. So to get us started, tell those listening, you know, who won't have yet seen your latest book, because it's literally brand new, what your goal was with it. What's it about? Like, how did this come to pass? And what was the message you most of all wanted to get across with it?
My previous book, New Naturalism, was really a design book. And, you know, I finished that and realized there was so much more to say, right? I mean, as soon as you design and kind of conceive of making a new garden in a new way, what happens next? And so I was chronicling in some ways my own journey where in 2017, I bought my home and garden we call Three Oaks. And, you know, this process of sort of unlearning a little bit about how we think about gardens and our roles in gardens, you know, requires a little bit of unraveling to think about, or maybe to rethink how we work in a natural garden and what work is, and what labor is. So that's what this book is trying to address: is how do you garden differently?
Yeah. Well, throughout the book, it seemed to me that the garden and the gardener are very engaged, very working in concert, intimate, involved, you know, and I think that's very realistic when one is talking about a natural garden, especially because it's like these are not gardens, and hopefully no gardens are, but but some are. So these are not gardens that are something that you just sort of install, you know, imprint on the place and stand back and admire, you know, like a painting on the wall or something. I mean, these are gardens of engagement. And you say in the book, in The Natural Garden, you say that in the process of gardening, the gardener becomes a keystone species. You say, quote, an active positive force of ecological disturbance. Tell us more about that take on things, the idea of each of us potentially becoming a keystone species of this community, this habitat.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this idea of a keystone species, of course, is a classical notion in ecology. And I remember, you know, learning about it in a graduate seminar in conservation biology and probably hadn't thought about it again for years later until you start to realize, and it's a proxy comparison, if you will, but if you start to realize that, I mean, a garden built of one's aesthetic interests or collector purposes or passions otherwise wouldn't exist without those things. So if you take that away for a moment and you think, okay, well, the garden I'm endeavoring to create is suddenly a habitat, is a home for other things, not as if those creatures weren't there already, but is suddenly now directed and intentional about a specific purpose. You start to think again about yourself as, a bit of a co-conspirator, but the labor is different. The effort is different. And so I've heard people say to me over the years, well, if I, how, it's like an identity crisis. What will I do in a natural garden if plants are the ones that are suddenly in the lead? And I think the idea is to say, like, well, a keystone species in nature isn't doing all of the things, but its efforts and its presence and its role is sort of what keeps a lot of other things in orbit. And so it's one way to kind of rethink or reshift the idea of what it means to be a gardener.
Yeah. I loved there's one page or section called How to Know a Plant. And it's sort of something I'm obsessed with that really happened to me. The wanting to really know a plant happened to me early on as a gardener, having to do with weeds.
Yeah.
And I was like fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting, and then I realized I didn't even know their damn names.
Yes,
Do you know what I
right.
mean? I
Yes.
didn't know if they were rhizomatous or if they had, whatever. I didn't know if they were biennial, annual, or perennial. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what their secret weapons were. I didn't know their life histories, And I thought, know your weeds, right? And then maybe you can outsmart some of them.
Yeah.
So anyway, it came, that's how I got it. So when I read, when I came to that page, I turned to that page and I said, "How to Know a Plant." I was like, "Yes." So now that's not exactly what your section is about, but you encourage us to get familiar, really familiar with the plants we planted that are going to make up the garden, what their roles are, how long they live, all these things. So let's talk about that a little bit and why you ask us that in the book, or tell us that in the book, how to know a plant. You imply that we need to know a plant, each plant.
I love your anecdote because and we actually I write an essay about weeding in that kind of in that very notion because we have a rule here at home. If you can't pull it if you can't name it, right? You can't weed it out if you can't identify it or
Right.
have some understanding. I mean, if you literally can't label it even or acknowledge it in name, what do you really know about it? Beyond a few passing glimpses. And so I think the thing that's, I think a lot of people in real time are out there learning is that, they're maybe they're adding more native plants or they're growing native plants from different sources before. Showy goldenrod is not showy goldenrod is not showy goldenrod. There's plants are more than just even just a name. In fact, they're particularly broadly distributed species, like a showy goldenrod, for instance. From different provenances, different places could behave entirely differently in a garden, not of any place, not to mention just the one place, you may be gardening. And so, understanding the complexities of even individuals of a plant species can start to shed an enormous amount of light on some of the conundrums we face as gardeners and why we're confounded by the way plants behave sometimes, as we encounter them.
Well, like one attribute that you mentioned in that section, how long does it live? You
Yeah.
tell us to go. And I mean, that just opens the whole floodgate, of like succession and who's going to outlive who and who's going to, what's going to happen over time, like time-lapse photography, so to
Yeah.
speak,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, no, I mean the life history thing is one dimension, but lifespan is
Yes.
sometimes you make a new garden and that first year can be brutal. And you can think, why am I doing this? Like, what have I done? I mean, it feels like you've opened Pandora's box. But oftentimes that initial response of a site, its most recent natural history expressing itself, is expressed in short-lived ruderal, annual, or biennial species. And those so-called problems, as it may seem when you're confronting them, may not really be that problematic in the long run. It may just be a question of patience and time.
So some things that initially get going, so to speak, more quickly, while the more slow to develop plants haven't filled in yet, but those slower to develop plants will eventually outcompete some of those early starters in some cases. Is that what you
In a
mean?
lot of cases, that's very, I mean, it's, like anything in ecology, there are a few universal rules like that apply equally in all circumstances. But, that is to say, in a meadow, for instance, in the first year, we don't usually get too hung up on a lot of weedy annual species. The only caveat being that, if it's a species that can seed bank really well, we don't want to permit it to go to seed if we can help it. We'd like to intervene if we can. So there's some nuance certainly about how any of these ideas come to be applied. But in the grand scheme of the world, it's like triage, right? It's like if you're going to be worrying about something, annual weeds the first year after a new planting, maybe aren't the highest thing on my list.
On the other hand, the other part of that is that sometimes in the early years of a planting, I may have chosen as a gardener, oh, I'm going to have this annual or this biennial, and I love it, and I get kind of attached to it, and then 3 to 5 years later, oops, I don't have it anymore, and I'm upset, I'm frustrated, and I don't understand, or at least the first time that happens to you as a more naturalistic gardener, you don't understand what happened. Why didn't that stay with me? Because we were more accustomed, maybe, to, if we were gardening as I said in the introduction, more the sort of more traditional, ornamentally focused manner. We knew those plants. We knew what we called annuals and so forth. We didn't expect our zinnias to come back next year. But in this case, when I'm making a meadow or something, I didn't think, that they would disappear. I thought they were part of the palette, and it's frustrating. It's confusing.
Well, and that's always then the opportunity to think, how do I introduce a little disturbance, a little chaos into the system to create an opportunity for those species to live? And that's one of the things about gardening that's inherently, I think, true for a lot of us, is it's in ecological terms fairly disturbing. And disturbance has positive effects. Like, it can be a way to keep some species in the system, annual species that might have been more prevalent in the early years of a landscape or planting, with us over the long haul if we devise a way to give them a niche to fill in the years to come.
So disturbance, meaning
Could be
kind of
agitation. Yeah, it could be
cultivating a
bad.
little soil here or there to give them a
Yeah.
space, an open some an opening, so to speak.
Absolutely. It could be agitation of the soil bed. It could be removing something that's died and leaving that space under careful watch, perhaps, to respond in its own right if something that you had in an earlier life of the planting is in the seed bank or something. It's it could just be a reason maybe to expand a planting or expand the shape of a bed or something, to again create just a little more sort of disturbed edge for a species like that to appear.
And sort of on the other side of that, sometimes disturbance, like I have a meadow and I have woody things coming into it, that the succession, and so I've got like rubus and all kinds of naughty creatures. And when you go to, if you weed those out and if you decide you're going to either dig or pull or, well, you can open up. You can make disturbances, and
Yeah,
some of
right.
those can really backfire, and you get
Yeah.
worse stuff.
It's a
So,
question of knowing when to, promote a sense of stability and when to, toss the dice.
is it always an experiment? I mean, even at your level of expertise and with all the gardens you've designed and worked on and so forth, is it always? Does it remain an adventure, or is there a rule book? A really firm rule book, because it seemed to me from this book, you're giving us ways of thinking, but there
Yeah.
isn't an exact answer to every circumstance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. We teach a continuing education program called the New Naturalism Academy through the studio. And we often tell people on the very first night of every session that the question is really about what it depends on. It's like all things
Right.
depend on. And so, the book is, as you note, about trying to establish a pattern framework so that you can start to detect and, see patterns, in a kind of general sort of way, in a template kind of way. But it does remain an adventure in some ways because you can take these concepts, these narratives, these frameworks from ecology. But the thing is what we're trying to do in gardens is we're trying to take a science that's built at the scale of a landscape and fit it into the form of something that's much smaller and thus much more prone to random effects of disturbance or even just chance alone. And so it is kind of a new frontier in that way, is that we know a lot about ecology in the world. There's a lot we don't know about, but we know a lot about, landscape ecology. We don't know a lot about landscape ecology at really small, finite scales, at a half acre in someone's backyard. And so that's that is what keeps it interesting for me in practice, for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point that the scale is another factor because it's, it may be in the location that we have information about the ecology of that region and the soils and the climate and the this and the that, but when we know the native plants theoretically of that area, but when you slice it that small, we don't really know what that how that impacts it. That's an interesting point. You have a section in another section of the book that caught my eye. I think it's in one of the chapters, and I should say that the chapters or sections, I don't know, of the book, they have interesting titles. It's not like spring, summer, fall, and winter or whatever. Like most garden books are perennials, annuals, bulbs, and trees, or whatever. The four sections, I think, are place, complexity, legibility, and flow. So in the one in the section about legibility, you have a discussion of something called five ways to develop your natural style. And I suspect maybe some of those are tenets that you help your design clients to grasp, or you learned from having worked with design clients, or I don't know if that things that you felt like people always needed to know or whatever. I wondered if we could talk about those five a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, these ideas, I think, come from my kind of long position that when you can relate a landscape to people's sense of style, just simply how they want to see and live in the world, it creates a more authentic experience. I mean, people care about the nature that they can experience, and the nature that so many of us get to experience is that which is just beyond the window or the door of the places we live and work. And so I think, to the comment we just made about all the things we don't understand about natural gardens at a small scale, the reason it's still important is because it is so often the nature that we experience. And so I think when we can find ways to relate to it and understand it and revel in it, the more that it means something to us in the way we go about our life. And so as you think about ways to sort of, take a more traditional approach to gardening into a natural realm, there's elements of style, a la Strunk and White, that are important to consider.
So one of the, I think the first sort of these five ways you say to develop, you say discover your interests. So tell me about what does that mandate sort of or that mantra mean?
I think, people are coming to this topic, this interest in gardening with natives and pollinators from all these different, motivations, whether it's native plants or whether it's pollinators, whether it's habitat,
Right.
whether it's sense of place, whatever. So whatever that is, like you can hone in on that and find, a community of people out there on Facebook or in social media that can support that. You can find, somebody who's gone totally down the rabbit hole and found all the crazy places to go buy rare native plants or whatever. I mean, so like there's an interest group around each of these sort of subtopics that are kind of the launch pads into the
Okay. So if you're bird mad, you can go the if you
Yeah.
yeah, you can explore that, and you can say that's my big interest, and I want that to be an important in front of mind, so to speak. And
Absolutely.
yeah, and then you say the second one, you say translate, don't copy. Tell me what that means.
Well, the internet's a wild and wonderful place, but the world gets ever smaller click by click. And so sometimes it's easy to sort of pull up something and think, that's what I want to do without first considering where is that? And what does that have to do with the place
Right.
that I live and grow? It might be very inspiring, and it might even be, in that sense, creatively relevant, but it might not be realistic either.
Yeah. And then a really great number three is great. And a lot of us do this. We bite off more than we can chew. Experiment small scale first, you say,
Yeah,
which
I need
is.
to learn this one myself too. But I'm a scale guy, so I guess I like scale. For here, I am contradicting myself. But for most people, I think there's a just a rational, good sense bit of advice here that you should try it on a small scale first, just to see how it feels, right? And just to see to start to see what you don't know. And it's easy to scale up once
Yeah.
you get a little success.
And then another one that was, I just think is one of the best pieces of garden design advice, no matter what your style is. Repeat, repeat, repeat.
Yeah, I mean, if you hatch onto a good idea, don't put it on a pedestal and make it special. Like, keep doing it. It's like that recipe that you find in the, your favorite cookbook or something. You start to get really good at it, and you think, well, what if I added, this? And then you riff on it a little bit, and then you kind of play with it, and it starts to become, an underlying, pattern or rhythm, but it starts to take on a life of its own.
Yeah, and I think when a visitor comes and experiences a place, that is often what lends a lot of the coherence is
Yes.
the repetition that they may, at first glance, they may not understand the whole thing or take it all in, but they may see some common elements repeated, whether it's actual plants or colors or
Right.
shapes or whatever it is, some elements that pull it together, right?
It was a motif of
Yeah.
sorts.
Yeah. And then the hardest one on the list of the five ways to develop our natural style is don't underestimate the time or the effort it takes for an idea to develop. So is that like don't be impatient, don't be in a hurry?
It kind of is. I mean, because in one sense, one of the great beauties about natural gardening is the dimension of time, and celebrate the dimensions of change. You're not planting one garden; you're planting five gardens experienced over 5 years. I mean, it's that you're versioning yourself a little bit. And so I think sometimes, and I do this all the time. I'll be in the garden, in our own garden here in the middle of the summer, and I'll think, gosh, it just isn't working. And I'm photographing or I'm making notes about it. And then, like 6 months later, I realize, A, it wasn't all that bad. And B, it's like, well, that's just the step between where I started and where I think I'm going. And so sometimes the perspective of a cold climate in a winter does temper one's enthusiasms or passions one way or the other about that. But there is, I think it is a little bit of a piece of advice just to slow down and appreciate the journey and the process a little bit, because that's really what it's about.
And there's so much learning in that if you can slow down. There's so much learning potentially.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in the last few minutes, I also want to sort of ask an unrelated question since it's kind of catalog shopping season or just about. And a lot of times gardeners of all types with all of all, varieties we get sucked in by pretty colorful photos of this plant or that plant. And I wonder, do you think about color kind of right away when creating a design, or is that a primary element or a secondary element? Like, where does color fit in
Oh,
for you?
it's like the last thing I think about, if I'm being
Interesting. That's
honest. I
because,
almost
yeah.
never think about it first and foremost. In fact, I have a little scaffold that we teach about in the academy and that we use every day in practice. It's like a it's like a rubric against your own work, right? When we're going through and checking designs and or coming to the end of a process, one of those things that I often have to check myself on is, do we have a coherence of color? Do we have a sequencing of colors? Sometimes it happens just organically, not to sound kind of hokey about it, but it sometimes comes into its own reality because of particular associations or plant combinations or elements of plant communities we're building. But it's almost never something that's first and foremost on my mind. I'm much more interested in how do these plantings work? How do they live and thrive? And the aesthetic of it is obviously important, but it's tertiary at the earliest.
I just wanted to make you say that out loud because I took that away from the book and I felt like, again, at catalog season, you know what happens? Oh, look how pretty that. Oh, that's pretty color. Oh, you know what I mean? And those impulses aren't necessarily the way to shop for plants. Some of these other thoughts that we've been talking about, I think, are much more to the point. What's its role going to be? And how is it going to serve in the community we're building and so forth? But well, I want to congratulate you again on the book. So it's there's a lot going on. You're teaching, you do lecture all the time. You've got your design business. A lot of facets to the operation over there, Kelly.
I like to stay busy and engaged, I guess.
Apparently. Well, I'm so glad that you joined us today to talk about the new book and give us some advice. And like I said, we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. I appreciate it.
Okay. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. And on Facebook and on Instagram as at Away to Garden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.